Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is an amazing man, Dan Kittredge, who is executive director of the Bio-Nutrient Food Association. And we're going to talk to him today about things like minerals in the earth and restoring the way in which we eat to the old way. We'll challenge him on that. Kittredge manages two organic farms and has worked with farmers in Central America, Russia, and India, and across the U.S. to develop nutrient-dense food. Dan Kittredge, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Alan.
Well, let's start with you. Who are you?
Who am I? Currently, I'm a husband, a father, an organic farmer. My primary endeavor is as executive director of the Bio-Nutrient Food Association.
And what's that?
It's an organization designed to organize people around quality in the food supply. We're working with growers to help them understand biological systems so they can grow higher quality food with better nutrient levels. And those processes are, by their very nature, symbiotic and collaborative with biological, you know, overall environmental systems. So, in fact, we're working with growers to help them leverage the vitality of living systems to increase quality, which is determined by nutrient assays, by flavor, by aroma, by pest and disease resistance, by increased shelf life, and from the farmer's perspective, perhaps most importantly, by increased yield. Because we're working in harmony with biological systems, the genetic potential of the plants is more able to be realized. In the nature versus nurture debate, we would suggest that the nature of seeds, of plants, of the living system is exceptional. And the issue is nurture, where we have not been doing a good job nurturing the earth, the soil, the biological systems, feeding them as we would our own children or as those we care about. So we're working with farmers and growers of all sizes to help them understand how to do these things and most practically experience results. That's been the primary focus of our efforts thus far. Recently, in February, the Bio-Nutrient Food Association was formally accepted as a 501c3 nonprofit by the IRS. And so now we're expanding our mission, moving out more towards the consumer audience as well, people that actually eat food, and explaining to them the logistics of quality as far as flavor and, most importantly, the health-giving attributes of food. We have plenty of research which shows categorically that healthy food is better at reversing degenerative diseases than pharmaceuticals. The information is categorical on the research front. The important nuance, which I think has not been addressed, is the disparity between crops. So we have, take carrots, for instance. You can have a carrot which is extremely sweet and flavorful and crisp and delicious, and you can have a carrot which is bitter and dry, but most importantly, focus on the flavor. That flavor is your internal, highly sophisticated biological system, which determines relative nutrient quality. So you can have carrots that have, you know, great flavor and actually are very good for you, and you can have carrots which are bland and oftentimes even bitter. And that goes across the board, tomatoes, you know, cucumbers, beef, milk, you name it, grains.
Wait, let me stop you, Dan. Suppose you get an artificially constructed, genetically constructed carrot, which actually is sweeter and does taste better. There's some dangers there too, aren't there?
If genetic engineering has the capacity to produce actually nutritionally superior food, yeah, by all means, go for it. I suggest that the reality of the situation, when the actual science is considered in anything resembling a holistic fashion, that the most efficient, practical manner by which to do this is to work in harmony with biological systems. The genetic potential of nature is brilliant, it's profound, and it's totally underappreciated and underutilized.
So just to give you a hard time, if I may,
good luck.
The capitalists in this country will tell you, if you just keep your hands off the economic system, the great system will take care of itself. You're saying if we just kept our hands off our fruits and vegetables and other things, no?
I'm saying if we actively care for the land, proactively care for the land, then we will achieve plants that are growing quite vigorously with great nutritive levels, and from an economic standpoint is very economically attractive for smallholders.
We're talking to Dan Kittredge, the executive director of the Bio-Nutrient Food Association. Okay, Dan, so just to carry this conversation a little further, you said that if we treat the land correctly, so tell us what treating the land correctly would be.
Treating the land correctly starts with an implicit understanding that it's alive and that it's a living system. And when we can operate from that conceptual framework, paradigm, call it what you will, we can look into the relative vigor and vitality and systemic issues of that living system. In most cases, it's really not that complicated to understand systemic limiting factors and address them. That's all we're talking about. From basic biological systems perspective, we have limiting factors in the biological system, and when those limiting factors are present, the system functions less well. This is entirely antithetical to conventional agronomy, which sees it as a set of unliving pieces, effectively. But what we understand is that if there is sufficient water, if there's sufficient air, if there's sufficient organic matter, if there's sufficient disparity of species, of bacterial and fungal species, of which there are 4.5 million different soil species, and sufficient mineralogy, then we actually have the functional capacity to have a highly productive, vigorous, healthy, vital ecosystem. And functionally, we're talking about things like enzymes. I mean, logistically, we have limiting factors systemically in the soil, in the agricultural environment, where, take for instance, cobalt is missing or highly deficient, or molybdenum. These are not minerals that are conventionally addressed through agronomy, although we understand their systemic importance. Cobalt is the center of vitamin B12, which people may have heard of. We understand a lot of vegetarians and vegans have struggles with their diets because there's not sufficient B12 in their systems, and they get anemic and have various other systemic issues. When we don't have enough vitamin B12, we suffer physiologically with our vitality and energy and our capacity, and similarly, the soil life suffers. So when you don't have enough cobalt in your soil, the soil life is unable to function at anywhere near its full potential.
Okay, so let me say stop and ask you how we get that cobalt into the soil and how it became depleted in the first place.
Systemically, if you look at agriculture from a historical perspective, I happen to have my degree in history. Agriculture, as our Western sort of historians tell us, rose up roughly 10,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age, and agricultural civilizations rose up almost every single one. A major, long-lasting agricultural civilization rose up in a river valley. And they rose up in river valleys because systemically in river valleys you have on an annual basis the floods, which bring down minerals and organic matter, etc., to the soil. And the process of agriculture is functionally a harvesting process, a mining process. We're not putting back into the soil in most cases what we take out. And so if you functionally remove cobalt, you know, at a quarter pound per acre per year for, you know, 20 years, and you only had 15 pounds there to start with, you do the math. We've been, you know, performing agriculture on the same land for hundreds of years. We're tilling the soil, which is highly destructive, which facilitates leaching. We have, you know, in this area specifically, a relatively high level of annual rainfall, which means we have, you know, over the past 10,000 years, for instance, significant leaching, weathering of the underlying soil. You go to areas like Africa where they haven't had a glaciation or a volcanism for millions of years, and you've got very, very highly denuded soils. So systemically, we just have limiting factors in our systems. However it may have come to be, the species of bacteria and fungi are extremely crucial. There are millions of different species, and different species do different jobs. So certain species pick up copper and feed it to the plant. Certain species tie up toxins and make the soil more functional. Certain species can break down DDT and, you know, nuclear isotopes. The functionality of soil life is profound.
Okay, but I want to stop you there, Dan. You're making some very good points, but I want to make sure I understand. How do you correct the situation? Do you put the cobalt back in the soil? Do you put microorganisms back in the soil? How do you do it?
For starters, you understand the needs of a living system, and you create that environment. So you understand the living system needs water, needs air, needs carbon, needs these crucial component pieces. And then once you understand that, you work to systemically address where your issues are. It may be, in this case, right now, here in the Northeast, we have drought. And so people's soils are very dry. And guess what? Soil life needs water to function. If there's not any water in the soil, then systemically the biological system is not going to function. So we address, yes, I suggest to people that in courses I give, that if you cannot maintain hydration, you systemically are short-circuiting the biological process.
What if you can't? I mean, we're in a water crisis right now in the world.
So if you can't add water on top through irrigation, you must have the subsoil nicely flocculated or open so that capillary action can function from the subsoil. You know, we must have a balanced ecosystem where we have lakes and pools and ponds and streams, and we must manage them in a proactive fashion systemically in the landscape. This is a larger point on agriculture, but certainly I recommend systemically that there are things that I recommend people add to their soils, bring in from off-site. Besides harvesting local weeds and plants, which is very bioregional, I suggest the local deposits of hard rock, granite and basalt. Generally, in most areas, we have quarries where hard rocks are being dug up. This is the foundational material of our soil anyway. So we have byproduct. We have millions of tons of byproduct, which is finely ground stone dust, all across the country. And anywhere you've got roads or any kind of industry, a byproduct of industry is finely crushed local stone dust, which is a very broad spectrum mineral amendment, usually available at, in our region, $4 to $8 a ton. Very inexpensive. But I recommend systemically something as simple as local stone dust and seawater. The seawater has in it about 90 different minerals. You know, it is the naturally occurring material on the planet with the broadest spectrum of trace elements. I acknowledge that 96% of that mineral spectrum in seawater is sodium and chlorine, but you can easily remove the sodium and chlorine from seawater and with, you know, wood ashes. Functionally with lye. So you can basically bring in to your soil all those minerals you need.
But I get it. But in my neighborhood, we have some very wealthy people. They drive Priuses.
Yes.
They're conserving the environment. They're doing this. But, you know, you realize, of course, that when you start talking about bringing in seawater, but that's not enough. You got to sort of deal with the seawater and make sure that the bad things in the seawater are taken out. Who can afford that?
Anybody can go to the beach and go to an area where there's a kelp forest and pick up a 5-gallon bucket of seawater.
For their garden in the Berkshires?
They would need less than that. They would need 2 gallons.
Okay, so you get the kelp. What about the seawater itself?
The seawater itself. Get 2 1-gallon, you know, plastic jugs and take them to the ocean and harvest some seawater.
What about agribusiness? These giant businesses. Obviously, I go home on the trip home and I see... smell a huge amount of fertilizer being put into the land. I take it you don't approve of all of those fertilizers that we're using.
I suggest that if we understand biological systems, we can identify local, natural, oftentimes certifiably organic materials which will work better than the chemicals. The issue is not right or wrong. The issue is, you know, what is more successful. And functionally, if we work with the biological system, you will get better yields of better quality. And so we've been working with the farmers to help them understand that. And we can work within budgets and we make recommendations. I'm not saying you shouldn't use agribusiness, that companies that supply minerals are not beneficial, but companies that can supply minerals that are more natural and much more supportive and stimulative to the biological system. And when that happens, the farmers find that their yields go up, their quality goes up, their cost of production goes down, so we can compete economically with conventional agriculture. I suggest that if we work in a holistic fashion with biological systems, that we can create the reality we want to see. We don't need to fight things. I've spent, I'm not that old, but I've spent plenty of time fighting, against things. And I think systemically, strategically, that's bad strategy. I think that the good strategy for how we win is to create the reality we want to see. And I suggest that if we organize around food, there's a number of systemic solutions that will come about organically. If we focus on people, educating people about the differential between one bunch of carrots and another, and we give them the power to choose, the ability to discern before purchase, then we can direct economic incentive towards growers that do a better job. And that strategically is our objective with the organization, is to create the inexpensive empirical capacity for consumers to actually go to the grocery store and choose which bag of carrots will taste better, and therefore my children are more likely to eat. Go to the farmer's market, choose your CSA, however you want to do it. But not just individual consumers, give that capacity to Whole Foods, who's already interested, and say to them, you can choose which growers you buy from, and use economic leverage to inspire people to build soil. If anybody's concerned about environmental effects, yeah, I would suggest that systemically the best way to sequester carbon is to build soil. That you can build 0.5% organic matter per acre per year through basic biological management. There are 4 billion acres on the planet that are in agriculture. So if you do 0.5% of 2 million pounds, which is the top 6 inches of an acre, times 4 billion, that's how many pounds of carbon we can sequester through our currently existing agricultural system just by incentivizing biological management.
What do you mean by the word sequester?
Build stable humus, organic matter in the soil that has a half-life of hundreds of years, at least.
Dan Kittredge, we used to live many fewer years than we live now.
That's not true.
It isn't?
There are plenty of people who live on the land in all cultures around the planet who live well and active into their 90s and 100s. It's the quality of life.
When I say we, I mean we in this country are living 10, maybe more, years than we used to live. What's that about? In other words, if the impetus is to change the soil, to import all of this, why do we have to do it if, in fact, we're living longer?
I think quality of life is, of course, an obvious point to be bringing up. And just because you're aged does not mean you're vital. And there's no reason that we should be in such poor health. And I'm not just talking about people who are, into their 60s and 70s and 80s. I'm talking about people in my generation, which is people, I'm in my 30s and younger. We have degenerative disease across the spectrum in our culture. And that was the point I was working towards, was the corollaries for healthier plants are healthier people. And systemically, if we want to talk about creating solutions, then if anybody's got a problem with agribusiness, stop buying their products and start using more biological systems. If you've got a problem with the farm bill and who writes the farm bill and who pays who to get to write the farm bill, then stop putting your money into those systems that do that. That means you don't need to buy conventional fertilizer. You don't need to buy herbicides or fungicides or pesticides. If you simply don't need to buy them because your biological system is functioning well, that's a dramatic shift in capital, which I think is, what makes things move. From the consumer perspective, if we talk about people actually eating better and better quality food, we have the science that shows the effect on degenerative disease of quality food. We could actually have a healthening population,
okay,
systemically.
Stop.
And all the implications of that on the economic system.
We're talking to Dan Kitteridge, who is the executive director of the Bionutrient Food Association. Okay, there are people listening right now, so this guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about, but I don't get exactly what I'm supposed to do sitting in my house. I don't buy stuff that will harm me. He's given us some indication of what that might be, but what do I buy?
You buy the food that tastes the best. You let your tongue.
We sell a lot of sugar that way, you know.
That's not taste.
What is it?
I'm talking about the taste as a wine connoisseur would refer to taste, as in the after notes and the, you know, the body. What's the body of that flavor of that carrot? Does it have a body or is it bland?
Isn't this a very subjective way of doing it?
It's our most instinctual, natural way of doing it. And we are formally working on, if you want to join our organization, we will send you a kit with a little meter and a guide that you can use to test food. And we're building the capacity on our website for people to upload that information so we could actually have a crowdsourced, you know, database of where the best food is that mothers could use, you know, get the PTA involved and let the mothers, you know which farm stand has the best quality vegetables and fruits, you know, which grocery store to go to based on where the better flavor is, which may cause their children to actually eat their vegetables as they should, but they should want to. There are many actions people can take directly. I strongly suggest that because we're at the beginning of the growing season, that you consider growing some food, that you consider, you know, taking responsibility for your backyard or side yard or, you know, if you've got an acre or two, a couple thousand square feet, and work yourself to create that functioning biological system. You know, we each have our own little spot on the planet, and if a small number of us begin to create small little spots that are vibrant, that will be, you know, the actual manifestation of what I'm talking about. It's not like we have to have some top-down system. It's that we take responsibility for our environments, for our bodies, for our food, for our, you know, the places on the planet that we have control of. I would say at the core of that is our bodies, that our functional capacity as, you know, human organisms, beings, whatever you want to call us, whatever we are, it depends on the functionality of our physical body. And if our physical body is functioning at a high level, we are functioning at a high level. If you want to be, you know, inspired and happy and full of energy, your physiological being must be functioning well. And if you're eating food that is denatured or denuded, so is your body. So systemically, the more we each take responsibility for eating food that is really good, the more functional we will be. Anybody who actually, you know, wants to be a positive force.
Okay, so in every grocery store, there's a section that says organic food.
Mm-hmm.
Now, along comes Dan Kitteridge and the Bionutrient Food Association, but you're making it even a little bit more complicated in that you're telling us, okay, but you need to buy the kelp, you got to get the seawater, you got to do this or that. Should we be suspicious of organic food?
I grew up on an organic farm. I, from a very young age, was, you know, out weeding and planting, harvesting. My professional career has been spent as an organic farmer. My parents run an organization called NOFA. They run the Massachusetts chapter of NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. I've been actively involved in that organization functionally, you know, because the operation was run out of our house as a staff person for most of my growing up years. So as an organic farmer, I can say things that, you know, black people can say certain things, women can say certain things. I can say things as an organic farmer. I take that liberty. And that is that not all food is equal, that some organic carrots are quite good for you, some organic carrots are not. They may not be, you know, detrimental to you, but they're certainly not vitalizing. And some local carrots that are not organic may be better for you than some organic carrots from a nutritional, actual vitalizing perspective. And that follows across the board, whether you're biodynamic or whether you're permaculture, whether you're conventional. Some people do a good job and some people don't. And it depends on all the factors of the living system, the quality of the seed, the, you know, the sophistication of the fertility program, the health of the soil, any number of factors, climate, weather, of course, and I would suggest that labels are, you know, missing the point to some decent degree. I certainly agree that toxic synthetic materials are bad and shouldn't be used. They're not necessary. Right or wrong, good or bad, they're not necessary.
Here's an example of a toxic synthetic material. When you say, I agree they shouldn't
Roundup.
Be. Oh, okay.
You know, we have certified organic broad spectrum killers like Pyganic, which is a, you know, it's an organic pesticide which will kill every single, you know, insect in your entire field. As certified organic, we have, you know, organic has its shortcomings, as do all things.
What are the organic shortcomings?
Well, that very thing, that a lot of organic farmers are not doing a good job biologically and so are not, therefore, growing high-quality food. Here's just a little sort of, you know, piece of the puzzle for you. What we're looking for in our food are specific orders of compounds. We're looking for what's called, you know, phytonutrients, antioxidants. There's a whole spectrum of high-order compounds. There's essential oils. There's, you know, nutritional science these days is looking at these things and correlating them with, you know, health-giving attributes, with flavor, with aroma. And that's what we're looking for in our food. So if you know what a good peach smells like and tastes like, and you correlate that with peach you might be able to get out of the grocery store right now, there's a profound disparity. So what we're looking for is those compounds in our plants. Interestingly, insects do not have the capacity to digest those compounds.
Which compounds?
The high-order compounds, the antioxidants, the phytonutrients, the essential oils, all those things nutritionists are saying are the most important for us and that correlate with flavor and aroma. So insects don't have the functional capacity to digest those compounds. Fungi don't have the functional capacity to digest plants that have those compounds in them. Bacterial diseases. Functionally, if your plant is susceptible to a disease or an insect pest, it should not be eaten by animals. The compounds in that plant are less than optimal for the animal kingdom. And therefore, the insects are going in there, doing their job, and cleaning up that weak genetic material so that it doesn't have the chance to reproduce.
Let me see if I get this straight. I got an apricot tree that I bought, and mm-hmm. every year it blossoms, and then you get the fruit. And the day before I pick those fruit, they're gone. Other animals, other than us.
Animals are different than insects.
Right. Other animals have grabbed them. Okay.
That's a good sign.
Okay. That's a good sign, but I don't have any apricots. But
from a biological perspective, those apricots would have been good for you.
Right, but I can't get them. Okay. So maybe I should put something on them.
No. What I'm saying
better
is...
Better the squirrels than...
If the squirrels like them, they would have been good for you. In most cases, the apples, the peaches, the pears, the tomatoes, the cucumbers, the potatoes that we eat would have been eaten by insects or diseases if they hadn't been killed. And that means that those crops were less than optimal for
sure.
us. And as an organic farmer, I grew up on a farm where we had potato bugs every year eat our potato plants, where we had, you know, powdery mildew kill our squash, where we had early blight take out our tomatoes, when we had pests and diseases on our farm that from a biological standpoint showed those crops to be less than optimal. And I think, as an organic farmer, that we should all hold ourselves to a higher standard of actual quality and not just a label. And that's the point we're trying to bring forth, and we're trying to facilitate that from a, you know, a deep political, economic, strategic perspective, which is basically enlightened self-interest. Can we help the farmers understand their enlightened self-interest in doing the right thing? Can we help the consumers understand their enlightened self-interest in doing the right thing? Can we help the you know, the retail chains, you know, all sort of sectors of society to understand that it's actually in our collective and individual best interest to be more biologically functioning?
Okay, we got 300 million people in this country, more.
Mm-hmm.
Your organization, the Bio-Nutrient Food Association, would like to get through to 300 million people, but my God, this is quite a task, isn't it?
Would we like to get through to 300 million people? I don't think so. We would like to get through to the food production system. And the 300 million people don't need to know that their food's getting better. If we have 0.5% or 1% or 5% actively engaged, if we have enough education and awareness in a small enough sector of the appropriate strategic sectors, we can logistically shift the food production system, I would argue, using economics and enlightened self-interest. We have lots of good information. We're actively on the ground working with farmers. You know, we are very active here in the Northeast. There are companies and other organizations across the country that are, you know, actively managing millions of acres, if not tens of millions of acres, you know, in this country of agricultural land. We have the functional capacity on the ground to make this happen. And, you know, we don't really have the education and awareness on the consumer end to drive it economically. And I think economics is important. So that's part of what we're trying to do as an organization, is to raise awareness and inspire understanding and action.
Dan Kittredge, how did this organization start?
This organization, the Bionutrient Food Association, is an outgrowth of the Real Food Campaign, or it's the culmination of the Real Food Campaign, perhaps, which has been doing this work primarily with farmers and growers across the Northeast. We've given year-long comprehensive growing seminars to about 800 growers in New England and New York in the past 3 years, 2.5 years, really. And that Real Food Campaign was a project of Remineralize the Earth. Remineralize the Earth is a nonprofit organization that's based in Northampton, Mass. It's been around for about 20 years. And Remineralize the Earth is based on, is a sort of an educational nonprofit whose mission is to help people understand the functional denuding of the soil and its effect on the vitality of the planet, that we have in many places in the planet eroded and denuded soils, and that if we systemically added locally occurring rock minerals, we could systemically revitalize major portions of the planet. From a biological perspective, we have a series of, you know, fairly simple to address limiting factors, and we can solve those limiting factors in a coherent and strategic and comprehensive and highly inexpensive fashion through local naturally occurring materials.
Are you optimistic?
Extraordinarily.
How so?
We've already won.
How so?
All the pieces are in place. The energy is moving forward. That, you know, the I would suggest that the reductionist, sort of purely analytical, abiotic, mechanistic paradigm is collapsing.
I got to go back to the word analytical. You lost me on that one. What's that?
Let me rephrase. The reductionist, abiotic, mechanistic paradigm is collapsing, and it has shown it has you know wrought the effect that it would naturally do through the effect of applying its assumptions. And the only opportunity to build vitality is by working in collaboration with nature, with living systems, with coherence. And the capacity to do this is so simple. It's so natural and it's so easy if you just do some basic things. And, you know, a lot of people are, you know, in various states of distress and suffering right now, and people are looking for answers. And if we can provide a coherent perspective that's empowering, that's grassroots, that's inexpensive, that's local, that's, you know, natural, then I think people will just by sheer, you know, necessity, move towards it.
And so, if we can. So, Dan Kittredge, let's go back. And for those people who are just joining us now, give us a laundry list of things that we need to do to assist us in this mission, making our soils better. You mentioned getting seawater. You mentioned getting kelp. You mentioned getting minerals.
Basalts and granites.
Yeah. What else do we have to do?
The biggest thing we have to do is to shift our paradigm. The biggest blockage is, as they say, between the ears. And we do not conceive of our soil, our bodies, you know, as really living systems. And if we were to take care of our bodies as a living system and our soils and our families as living systems, we would, you know, rapidly improve our state.
Now, Dan, not to give you too hard a time, but there's got to be somebody sitting up there at Cornell Extension or these other places who's saying, we do all of that. That's why we have fertilizers. That's why we've developed what we have in this country.
The history of agronomy in this country, at least for the past 50 years, has been very reductionist in its nature.
What do you mean by reductionist?
It has not. It's been single factor analysis, and it has not been biological in its assumptions. The agronomical sort of conventional wisdom is a chemical process, as in chemistry, with single ions. The biological understanding that we have life in the soil that are actually the digestive tract of our plant. That conceptual framework is nowhere to be seen in agronomy in the mainstream.
But there are agronomists who would say, no, you're wrong. I mean, I'm not one of them because I don't know the field, but they're obviously saying, we do that all the time. We know who's in, we know who and what is in our soil, and we deal with it.
There are assumed to be 4.5 million species of soil life. That's bacteria and fungi, just two kingdoms. We have formally identified as microbiologists in all countries, with all languages, in all decades, about 3 to 5% of the species, simply having identified them and named them, not necessarily even figured out what all they do. We really do not understand the biological system. We've been operating with a chemistry mentality, a soluble ions in solution that's appropriate for, you know, building, you know, iron and you know, things like that, plastics. But it's not a biological analysis. We do not have a biological understanding. So that's the biggest issue. And once you understand the biological system or can begin to grok it, then you can find, you know, any number of things around your house.
What do you
locally
mean begin to grok it? I'm sorry. When I hear a word I don't understand, I want to ask about it.
Grok?
Grok, yeah.
Grok is sort of like to have the perspective shift into place.
Okay.
When a new paradigm makes itself evident, you grok something.
Okay.
To grok the biological system means you need to understand that really what's going on is that the plant is, through photosynthesis, making sugar and feeding a lot of that sugar that it makes through photosynthesis out through the roots to feed its livestock. Functionally, what the plant does is make sugar to feed soil life. And it feeds the soil life sugar so they can go out and access from the soil the minerals the plant needs, which they will then feed back up to the plant and help the plant grow. And that's how the system works. And once you understand that that's what's going on, then you can identify where your issues may be. So, you know, if your soil is too dry, then you're short-circuiting the system. If you don't have any air in the system, if you're waterlogged, no one down there can breathe. They're all asphyxiating. That's the gut. If you've applied toxic materials, you've killed off your gut. That's like taking antibiotics, right? If we understand gut health for us, then think about gut health for them. If we understand vitamins for us, if we understand that we need to have our B12 and our vitamin C and our essential fatty acids for our bodies, then understand the plants need that also. And if we can give them things like seawater or kelp or, you know, weed tea or compost tea or ground up granite or basalt or any number of other readily available, highly inexpensive, available everywhere on the planet is the point, is local natural things. If we understand what the plant needs and when, and we can give the plant that, it'll grow better. And if when we do a few basic things, then you have dramatically increased yields and nutrition. And thereby it becomes more, you know, economically advantageous or possible for you to be a functional farmer or a homesteader or whatever you are, if you're in India or you're in Central Asia or you're in, you know, Central Africa or you're, you know, anywhere on the planet where people are living subsistence lifestyles on worn out land, we have the functional capacity to empower them.
You say you're optimistic.
Extremely.
And I say, wait a second, Dan Kittredge. I go back to the people who own Priuses to conserve gas and to do the right thing. But it takes money. It takes a lot of money to do all of this. And you haven't got it. The world isn't going to turn around on a dime and say to agribusiness, we want you to change the way you're behaving. It seems kind of naive to me.
Well, there's always doubters and skeptics. And, you know, we're busy on the ground building a movement. You know, social movements are needed in today's, you know, milieu, I would suggest. And if we can inspire mothers to, you know, do things that are better for their children, if we can inspire farmers to do things that are better for their soil, then, you know,
one step at a time.
We're, you know, it has to be grassroots. Mm-hmm. It has to be, you know, decentralized and organic and word of mouth. And if it's true, it'll work. And if it's not, it won't. And it seems to be working. So, you know, I'm very, very.
Wait, I'm sorry, Dan, and I don't want to give you a hard time, but if you say it seems to be working, but you started this program by saying we're ruining our soil, how's it working?
How is the biological system working?
How is your program working if, in fact, you started by saying we're killing our soil, we're not doing this
agriculture
stuff?
Agriculture writ large has historically denuded soils across the planet.
All right.
Those who are working, you know, in a biological system to manage their soils are, you know, very, very happy, quite successful. You know, it happens to be economically quite lucrative, because your cost of business goes down, your cost of production goes down, and your yield goes up. And with simple basic economics, you have, you know, the functional capacity for a farmer to be more viable.
Now, how, Dan Kittredge, does your degree, which you told us is in
history,
help you in terms of this mission of yours?
Oh, I would suggest that if you want to talk about my education, it's been through the School of Life. And the fact that I happened to go to university and happened to get a liberal arts degree is, you know, 4 years of the process. I've spent, you know, a lot of time in a lot of countries, working for different organizations, doing different projects and endeavors. So my background growing up on an organic farm, in a house that was the center of an organic farming organization, gives me, I think, the life experience to be able to speak to these topics specifically.
Why didn't you major in science?
Because I was looking for the purpose of life. When I, you know, got to, you know, my undergraduate, whatever it is, when you show up ahead of time, and there was I got the course catalog, and there was a course called Human Nature, and I was like, oh, finally. Finally, I can learn something. I've been waiting through 13 years of just boredom, and finally I can learn something interesting. It was Anthropology 101 and Lucy and the Early Hominids. It had nothing to do with human nature. And then there was a well-written, you know, higher order physics class, which I took, you know, 20th century physics. And then there was the history of Western thought. And then I was actually accepted as a music major.
And where was this?
UMass, uh-huh. Amherst. I dropped out before I finished and took off to India and, you know, lived in the Himalayas, and I did finally graduate. But I've been around a few places. I've gone around the world a couple of times. Basically, historically, for the past, you know, for about 10 years of my life, I managed my parents' farm in the summer and then traveled in the winter.
How does somebody get in touch with you?
We have two websites currently. TheRealFoodCampaign.org is our old website, which is being replaced by bionutrient.org, bionutrient.
Is there a reason for that?
The Real Food Campaign was a project to remineralize the earth, and bionutrient.org is going to be the hub for our activities in the future. So, we waited until we had our formal 501c3 status from the IRS as a a tax-exempt educational blah, 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 to launch that site, which just happened last month, and we're still building it. So functionally right now, realfoodcampaign.org and bionutrient.org are the two websites.
Let's go over it. Dan Kittredge, and the name of the organization is Bionutrient Food Association. When somebody who you have recommended does grassroots, digs up their rear garden, decides they're going to do it right, give us a laundry list of things they have to do.
The reason we have been spending most of our time on educational courses is because it's really not that hard, and it does take more than 5 minutes to explain it.
We'll try.
I'll give you an overview,
sure.
But the logistics and details and nuances are what our organization is there to to help you with.
Fine.
I would suggest starting in the fall. If you're going to start, the best time of the year is around the fall equinox. End of September, to take a soil test to simply identify what's there and what's not there. And we understand that there's a critical roles for sulfur and phosphorus and potassium and calcium, magnesium, boron, manganese, copper, zinc, cobalt, molybdenum, selenium. There's a number of minerals that are critical for biological systems.
Where do you bring this, by the way?
I recommend people send their soil tests to a lab in Ohio called Logan Lab. I've got a special test through them that's $25, and it's called the Base Plus test.
Okay.
And it identifies all these minerals and then systemically address deficiencies. So in the fall, identify what you're missing and put it into the soil. Ideally, you're putting your cover crops down, your oats or your rye, so you're keeping the soil alive during the winter, and you put those minerals down then, or put them into a compost pile if you've got a compost pile, and then when you spread your compost on the garden in the spring, it'll be there. Whatever your system is, different people have different infrastructures. Identify those limiting factors, address them, then next look to your seed, and I would inoculate seed, which is adding the spores of bacterial and fungal communities to those seeds before they germinate. It's like a colostrum. If you understand that a baby needs its mother's colostrum, so to set the digestive tract before it can begin to digest, we need to set the digestive tract of the seed before it's born, before it germinates. So we add the species of bacteria and fungi at that point. If you've got potting soil, look into the mineralogical spectrum in your potting soil. That's like the early childhood nutrition status of your plant. What's your plant being fed in its first 5 years of life? What's in your potting soil? I like to look at seed and seed size and seed quality. You can get highly vigorous seeds that are larger and heavier and much smaller seeds. I cannot recommend any seed company in the country currently that is doing a good job with seed. It is the issue.
But you said I'm getting a laundry list from you, from somebody.
I would suggest logistically that right now you need to save your own seed. That we cannot guarantee any high quality seed from any soil, any seed company in the country. I'm working on it, but we've got issues within the supply chain. It's a big business, and they have not been sorting for quality. Systemically, they've been sorting for other metrics. So saving your own seed, call up your seed companies and ask them for the largest seed of any specific variety. And they do have differentials. So you can ask them for a larger seed. I would minimize tillage. I would suggest establishing infrastructure for both irrigation and foliar spraying, so you can apply the vitamins to the plants in season, being able to maintain water for them, and to be able to feed them their enzymes and their vitamins through at the leaf surface level or into the root system or both. So that basically means having a backpack sprayer or having a drip tape or some other sort of basic irrigation infrastructure. And then we talk about logistics of monitoring plant vitality. The refractometer, which is a very, very simple device devised 150 years ago, basically is the best tool we have now for people to actually discern quality as the plant's growing or in the crop. And so if people actually like what I'm talking about and they want to join our organization, they can join at the participant level and get a refractometer and the Brix press and the chart, which they can use to actually go and test the empirical number quality of, this carrot is a 14, this carrot is a 6. But when the plants are growing, you can test their leaves to see the level of the vigor and the vitality in the plant by testing the refractometer reading on the leaf. You can test the electrical soil conductivity, which tells you how many minerals are moving in solution in the soil very easily. Again, it takes about 3.5 seconds to test this. The refractometer reading takes about, 15 seconds. And, there's no batteries. It's low tech, simple. You can use it 10,000 times. And then, of course, if you want to use in-season soil tests and in-season tissue analysis. And of course, you can do more sophisticated, in-season soil test analysis and tissue analysis if you want. But basically, we're helping people to identify systemically what are the limiting factors in their biological systems and provide simple, practical steps of things they can do, recipes, materials, harvest them, buy them, your choice, to provide the plant everything it needs as it's growing.
But when I put my garden in, I have enough trouble just going to a store or to a nursery and getting the seeds and putting them in. What you're asking people to do is fabulously difficult.
It's not fabulously difficult. It may sound overwhelming to you.
It does.
But if you make it a part of your life for an hour and a half a week during the growing season, it's really about all you need, if that, and it's extraordinarily fulfilling. both in your gut and your quality of life and your relationship to life.
Do you feel that you're in better physical shape than the rest of the people your age and your quality?
I would say that I'm not feeling like I'm in a, you know, high level of vigor and vitality, but I'm, you know, haven't been to a doctor since I was 16, and that was, or 18, that was to get a shot to go to, you know, some Russia, I think. I don't have physical ills. I, you know, feel very, fairly energetic.
Is this country in better or worse shape than other countries in the world?
Oh, that's a very complicated answer. On which level?
Well, are our soils better? Are our agricultural practices better? If you took us versus India, if you took us versus Israel, if you took us versus other places, how are we doing?
I think it's a, what do they call it? A false pretext. I would unposit your question, and I would reposit, where are the good growers in our town or our county that we can go and learn from? Because there's good growers everywhere. There's healthy people, the people that understand things, that, you know, let us simply work to create that reality we want to see, and do our best to empower those who are farther away from us. I think we can use our creative capacities. We can use our technological capacities. We can use a lot of the tools that are present in today's day and age that have not historically been present for empowerment to facilitate a reality that we all want to see.
Our guest is Dan Kittredge. He's the executive director of the Bionutrient Food Association. Dan, why don't you tell everybody how they can get in touch with you again?
The best contacts are bionutrient.org, which will be our central hub website, which is, it's still in development but active, and or realfoodcampaign.org.
And you'll be able to supply people with some instructions about how to go about all this. Is that right?
We give courses annually, usually two-day courses currently, one day in the fall, one day in the spring. We're just finishing up our series of courses this year. You can join the organization and get the refractometer kit so you can actually test quality of crops you buy or crops you're growing.
And give us a real fast explanation of a refractometer.
A refractometer is a simple tool. It's basically has a little glass slide on it that you put a drop of juice onto. That is a drop of a carrot, a drop of a cucumber, a drop from a tomato, drop from a potato, and you look through the eyepiece. It's a very, very simple 6-inch long instrument.
And what do you see when you look through the eyepiece?
You see a graph. You see 0 to 32 with a chart, and you see a line between the blue and the white, and that's your reading. And then you wipe off the slide and apply another drop.
Dan Kittredge, thank you so much for spending all this time with us. I know that it was quite a ride for you, and we appreciate your diligence. It does sound like you've bitten off a lot. You're optimistic, and I'm delighted you are. And so thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Alan, and it's an honor to be with you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.